Okay, good morning and welcome. We are here in the bowels of the Ulster Museum in South Belfast this July morning. And I'm very pleased to be with the authors of Bad Bridget, Crime, Mayhem and the Lives of Irish Immigrant Women, Elaine Farrell and Leanne McCormick. And we just want to have a chat really about the project, because it's a multifaceted project rather than just a book. But I suppose the very obvious place to begin is to ask you a little bit about the development, the evolution of the project and the kernel, the original kernel of the idea. You know, how did this project start?
Well, I tell our origin story. we're like a Marvel superhero. We started really because about literally 10 years ago, nearly exactly, we were at an event in the BBC, actually in Belfast, and we were chatting at the end, I think probably over the wine at the end, talking about what we were working on. Yeah. And Elaine had said, oh, she was working on looking at Irish women in crime in Boston. And I remember being really taken back and saying, that's really weird. I've just been in New York and I've been looking at Irish women and charity in New York. And before this, we knew each other and we knew each other's work and everything, but we were you know, working largely on Irish women in Ireland. That was our topic. So suddenly there was this, and I think it's a real serendipitous moment where we were like, Dawn, how funny that we've both really interested in knowing what happened to Irish women when they left Ireland. And so much of the discussion, the scholarship had been about really the good stories, those good migration stories. And for women, if they were mentioned at all, it was about, you know, women who were nuns or teachers or domestic servants, but who did well. And that was sort of positive stories. And I suppose coming from our own backgrounds, we were interested in when things didn't go so well.
Our research backgrounds.
Our research backgrounds, rather than just our backgrounds. Our backgrounds were impeccable.
The deviance is purely academic.
Yeah, so where our interest is completely. So we then got together to talk about whether there was a bigger research project, and we began to work on a plan for that. And we submitted the research to the HRC, which we were successful for, and that funded then the research trips. But we had started to use the name Bad Bridget kind of in a jokey way between the two of us. And then we were like, well, maybe actually we could use this, because, you know, Bad Bridget was a very common name, and also the fact that Biddy was used often en masse in America for towards domestic servants, and a sort of way of reclaiming it. But we do laugh about saying we had this genius idea that we would just check that Bad Bridget wasn't sort of somebody's porn name or something. And so we Googled it and nothing came up. And then afterwards we realised that really, we'd been on a university computer, which was firewalled. So, of course, nothing was going to come up anyway. So
We're typing in,
you know, wondering.
But your phone's probably better.
Yes, exactly.
I know.
So that was sort of where it all started, and how then we ended up beginning the project.
Okay, no, that's really interesting. And that serendipitous kind of, you know, where two people come together and it turns out they've got sort of parallel research interests and joining up the dots. I was sort of interested also in the extent to which you were sort of consciously seeing yourselves as engaged in women's history. You know, I think this is quite an interesting issue as somebody who's tried to dabble in looking at gender as an issue in terms of migration.
And very well, Paddy.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yes,
thank you so much.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I suppose in a way it's a bit like, could a man or two men have written this book?
I'm sure they could. Would they have done it as well as us? No, I don't. I'm sure they could, absolutely. I think our backgrounds were in women's history.
Yes.
So I think we were very conscious that we wanted to pull out women's stories.
Yeah.
And I think because we were both social historians as well, we were very keen to find women's voices where we could. And the crime records in Ireland as well as in North America are fantastic, because they do sometimes give those little fragments. You know, sometimes you'll get an entire statement that a suspect has relayed, or you'll also get witness accounts as well. Sometimes even newspapers will give a couple of quotes of what the woman said or the girl said when she was in court. And it might not be completely verbatim, but it might be, you know, kind of roughly what they said. And it's those kind of fragments that just give us a glimpse into the personalities of some of the girls and women. So we were really keen to pull those out as much as we could in the book, as well as in, you know, in the other kind of outputs that we have, the exhibition or in our podcast as well.
Sort of run parallel to that in a way. I always read the acknowledgements when I read the book, because I'm always interested in, you know, who's kind of building a little picture of your working life. And you both had young kids and obviously partners, and that sort of comes over in the acknowledgements, in the sense of, you know, that they're part of the team. But, you know, at the same time, whilst they're a useful support team, there's also all the challenges that come with trying to kind of do at least these two things in parallel. So sort of what reflections on the background story in your lives as professional historians?
I think we say in the acknowledgements that they completely slowed the writing process. I mean, and they absolutely did. I think being honest about it, it can be really tough when we and we kind of have moved through, you know, a lot of stages in the work, because when we started the work, you had no children.
I know, I was fancy free. I was heading off to Boston for weeks on end,
you know, and I had two kids who were quite small at that stage. Yeah. And you're sort of juggling, trying to get research trips in, and I kind of thought, I've got to get mine in too, you know, and you are relying on lots of people at home looking after children and trying to make sure that everything, the wheels keep turning. We're both of our other halves are academics, so that helps in one way, in that they understand, but also in the other way that they have also often similar demands. So it's trying to juggle all of those as well, that you can work. And Elaine, in a sense, has impeccable timing, because she managed to have two maternity leaves that extended both the initial HRC project and then the second HRC funding for the exhibition. So if you're after a collaborator, look for somebody who can manage to get two maternity leaves in as well. But I mean, that's again, those are huge life-changing events that happen, and it's not a matter of just then picking up where you left off, and you know, it's very tricky. So it's hard, it's tricky.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, I think it's been useful. I think that we're often perhaps both in those similar situations that we understand. Mm. We understand that sometimes children are sick.
Yeah.
No.
Sometimes you have to be back to do that pickup. There are sometimes, and that will restrict, and that is different, and it's different often for, you know, for people who maybe aren't in those situations, that you can say, well, I can do it between this time and this time, but I have to leave because I need to get back. It's not just it's important, because actually social services are going to get called if you don't turn up to pick up the child at a particular time.
But you do wonder, you know, if we didn't have children, I suppose, what the kind of how the project would have looked different, and not necessarily for the better. You know, I think it's also when I suppose, as a mother, then reading some of these stories about these women and being separated from their babies, I think also has an impact. And Leanne is there praising the maternity leave, but do you remember I went into labour and you had to head off? She had to head off to Dublin and deliver a paper on Bad Bridget that I was meant to have given. And I'm like stuck in the hospital, and I'm like, I'm sending all my stuff to her.
You know, there's a classic example of teamwork. So I'm really interested again. I'm a big fan. Like I like working. I wouldn't say that I don't like working on my own, but I like the energy that, you know, the teamwork dynamic of two people working on a project, because you've always got that sounding board and conversation about stuff and the interpretation of the evidence that you confront. So, I mean, reflections, not only, you know, a team of yourselves, you had worked alone largely before.
Yeah.
I mean, this was the first, I think for you as well, this was the first time that I'd worked on a big collaborative project.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like this, and I have sort of subsequently, but you know, also this is the this was the first, you know, and we work
our favourite.
Shh, anybody else is listening. But yeah, you know, and you do build up those relationships, and I can see where it could probably go horribly wrong as well, you know.
Yeah, no,
but
I'm
I mean,
sure, yeah.
You know, thankfully it.
So far.
Yeah, it didn't. You've kept it together. Very good. We did a book club in the Mellon Centre, and we had 16 or 17 people who came in and read through the book, and then we met and discussed it each week. One of the things, and it, needless to say, it went very favourably. just in case you were
delighted to hear.
No, very, very good, warm response. But one of the things, I think one of the patterns was that a lot of the readers really connected, as you might anticipate, with those chapters where you have the evidence to allow you to kind of develop biographical. So they kind of, you know, individual human stories that come through in particular, they were, I think that's where they, you know, really, they said that they loved that material. But you can't always get, this is the frustration, isn't it, that actually getting, you know, the body of material and then the contextualization of it's not easy to do that. So just sort of, I mean, any thoughts you might have about that as the people who produced it?
Yeah, it can be really difficult. Mm-hmm. You're working with fragments. Yeah. I mean, across our three cities, so we're looking at Boston, New York and Toronto, mm-hmm. We would have hundreds of thousands of Bad Bridget. So hundreds of thousands of these Irish girls and women who were accused of committing a crime.
Yeah.
So you know, when you're looking at similar names, mm-hmm. and ages, of course, change. You know, people are adding a few years or losing a few years. Clerks are writing down the age that they think the girl or woman might be. So you can't even go by that. So it can be really difficult to trace somebody. Yeah. And to be confident that is the same person, yeah. Yeah. That you have found. And we did, as much as we could, we were trying to trace them back to Ireland as well to see where, yeah. they have come from. But again, you know, there was, sometimes you've got this somebody by the same name leaving the island in the same year, yeah. and we just had no way to be able to tell. Sometimes with the prison records, when we get a prison file, mm-hmm. and they will give the parents' names, and that can then help to place them, because we were able to look up then birth certs or baptismal records, yeah. and then we're able to identify where that person has come from. But yeah, I mean, ideally we would be able to provide this kind of rounded bio of each person, but yeah, hopefully we've given enough examples that When we're given talks in various places, we do also like to pull out, yes. some of the local cases as, yeah. well, and so far we've managed to do it. So yeah, we have been able to trace quite a few of them.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that, you know, the transnational history is really challenging. So trying to make that link can be very difficult when you're looking at individual cases.
Yeah. And I mean, you're spending days and weeks trying to find somebody, and then you don't find them. No. You know, and it's kind of, you're kind of keep persevering, because I suppose we're historians, and we're like, we're going to do it, come on, you know. And then just it's a complete dead end, or you just can't, with any kind of degree of accuracy, can't identify that is the same person.
Yeah.
And you're sort of that hoping that yeah. must be them, but it might not be. But I think it was tricky for the book as well, where we were trying to, you know, choose our case studies for those people where we did have as much information as possible, and that there was a good story. But for a chapter like, for example, the chapter on drunks,
yeah.
we didn't have, you know, a key individual that we had lots of biographical information because of the nature of the crime.
Yeah, of course.
But we were keen to, because that, you know, drink-related crimes were the by far the largest number of kind of women being arrested or being prosecuted for it, that we wanted to make sure we included that as a representative, yeah. You know, chapter as well, but we're having to kind of piece together it in a different way often to the other chapters as well. So it's sort of trying to tell a rounded picture,
yes. yeah.
with sort of, because we could have picked out perhaps more, you know, kind of very different or unique or salacious,
yes.
crimes, but they,
yes.
weren't necessarily representative, no. as well of the wider picture, mm. too.
Thank you. from a contemporary perspective, one of the contrasts, and particularly perhaps as a male reader, that you're only too aware that so many of these institutions are effectively run and staffed by men. You know, whereas today that might be different in a woman's prison or any kind of institution, that these are male governors, male staff, and the dynamics that, you know, trying to imagine the dynamics within those institutions, and just the range of different institutions across those cities, it's kind of interesting to ponder. And there are those obvious cases again where, you know, what would seem like to us today simple, straightforward solutions to, or potential solutions to, problems that they never even tried. You know, so there's kind of a frustration about how the staff maybe didn't connect and understand the lives of the individual women.
Yeah, I think even looking at particular crimes, like these women, very often, the drunks that Leanne has referred to, who feature in the, you know, a lot of these they're dealing with alcohol issues and, you know, that kind of addiction issues and really needing support. And I suppose society hadn't developed in that way to kind of recognise. Sometimes when women's children are being taken away from them and then they're going back and they're checking up on them and they're saying, oh, they're just drinking. And you kind of think, yeah, but it's not necessarily, it might be the result of the children having been taken away. So yeah, it can be, sometimes the stories are just really, really sad. In relation to the gender issue, we see that coming up quite a lot actually with the policemen. We have these women and they're developing sometimes these kind of cat and mouse relationships with the policemen who are, you know, trying to catch them, and they have these great kind of oh, you got me this time, but you're not going to get me the next time. And we see that coming out particularly in the case of the theft, and the career criminals who are just stealing from department stores and everything. What we also see in the 19th century though is that the kind of awareness of gender issues, so we use some of the records from the women's reformatory prison in Massachusetts, which is about 20 miles from Boston. And we see there, when that was established in the 1870s, they had women staff. Mm-hmm. And it was very much modelled on Mountjoy Irish Female Convict Prison, where they had put in female staff. Mm-hmm. And these are for the, I suppose, more serious offenders rather than the women who are in for a couple of days. You know, these are the ones who are in for kind of a year or more. So we do see that that kind of awareness. And I suppose it's about, these prisons develop about, it's about punishment as well as reformation. And sometimes these female staff then are kind of presented as these are role models. And in an Irish context, that was sometimes with religious sisters who are kind of presented as this is the ideal woman and this is a good role model. And we see that sometimes coming up in the US in particular, I think, with some of the Magdalene laundries.
Yeah, you do see that they take on, the Good Shepherds, for example, take on in all of our cities take on a sort of a role in terms of that, more of a reformation. They work directly with the kind of state organisations, with the courts to take women, and kind of the idea that it'll be a sort of a reformation. So while something similar would have often happened in Ireland, but it may have been in not quite as an official capacity. So the idea that you could end up being sent to a Magdalene laundry for an offence, but perhaps there might not be a set date for your release as such. Mm-hmm. There would be more of a structured sort of, it was more of a, you were in for 2 years or you were in for a year, and the idea that you would be sort of released again. So you do see again those religious orders operating, but again they're seen as those kind of the ideal people to be involved with this, and particularly for younger women, you know, that this is a way of saving them from prison.
One of the things that I marked a lot with my pencil as I went through reading was the presence, it's maybe not good to phrase it that I was pleased to see it, but I thought it was interesting, the Protestant women who, again, you know, the well-worn stereotype I'm only too familiar with of, you know, 18th century frontiers man, but actually here you have a strong representation. And I think, again, your inclusion of Toronto, you know, reinforces that. But, you know, it's so helpful to have this presence, you know, have a light shone upon it and recognise that this is very much part of an Ulster Protestant migration narrative that we really do need to know a lot more about. So it's delighted as a professional historian to see it. I wasn't delighted on behalf of the women's lives, but I thought that was really interesting. Any other kind of, you know, just in terms of how Toronto, you know, compared with the US cities, any sort of things or patterns that you thought were interesting or different?
I mean, we included Toronto exactly for the reason that you suggested, because we kind of had the idea, well, we'll see what was happening in terms of that this sort of Protestant migration, because again, that was one of the things that we were very keen to do, again, coming from our backgrounds and working what we worked on, just to show that this is not this sort of this is not all just about these sort of young Catholic women who are migrating, that actually there's a much bit bigger picture. So we included Toronto for that reason, with the idea that we thought, we'll see, it'll be different, we'll see all these different things. Of course, we just saw exactly the same things happening, and we could see in our other cities as well. Often women sometimes making those statements that they were, sometimes people would say they were Scots-Irish, sometimes people would make, you know, they would make different, or make it quite clear that they were that they were Protestant, and often that was particularly understandably if they were engaging with a Protestant charity, you know, they were making those kind of clarifications too. But in Boston we were seeing, in Toronto, sorry, we were seeing often very similar patterns. Toronto was sort of slightly different because, of course, it's kind of a little bit later in terms of its development and growth, so we were seeing things kind of coming, you know, developing a little bit later than some of the other cities. But also things like Toronto had a very clear, you know, by the end of the 19th century they've got a kind of morality section, a proper morality police, but they're very, also very early in with the Andrew Mercer reformatory, they're about again pushing this idea of reformation and about kind of quite advanced in the way they were thinking about things, but also more concerned about the idea of the problem girl on the street that we see perhaps more than in other places. But that's probably to do as well with the smaller size of Toronto too. Okay. And I think the ability to be able to try and manage that city centre more carefully than perhaps sprawling bits of Boston and New York. I think there were attempts there. But again, different dynamics happening there. For example, in our Letitia Armstrong case, where we could see things relating to, you know, the Orange Order and different social forces and controls and political influences than perhaps you were seeing in either New York or Boston. But women being arrested for the same crimes and
very similar,
you know,
broad,
yes,
social pattern.
Exactly. There was no great difference in terms of behaviours or attitudes towards
a useful
towards
message
women.
In itself.
Yes.
sort of thinking again, but I often go on, you know, yes, they're crossing 3,000 miles of ocean, but when you boil it all down, it's really rural. A lot of it is rural urban migration. So you have these young women, largely with a rural background in Ireland, transitioned into this, you know, huge urban sprawl, and that. The shock of that transition, often relatively rapidly, must have been part of, particularly where you had mental illness and so on, and just the difficulty of adjustment to a very different world.
It must have been a complete shock. So as well as, you know, you've left your family and your friends behind, you've left everything you know, but you're arriving to these, you know, vast countries. But the climate is also very different. You know, you've got the really hot summers, you've got the really cold winters, and we can see that coming up quite a lot, that the Irish families were just not necessarily prepared for the kind of economic costs of those harsh winters. So we can definitely see that, and the sensory shock as well, and that was something that we really tried to convey in the exhibition at the Ulster American Folk Park, and you know, that idea of the smells, what did the US, what did Canada smell like, and how was that different to Ireland, and you know, what were the sounds, and how might that have been different as well. But yeah, it must have been, for somebody who came from rural Ireland, you know, what were the nights like? The sounds of the nights must have been so different compared to then, you know, you're living in Five Points in New York, say, with all the fights and the drinking and everything that's going on the streets below. So yeah, it must have been an absolute complete shock for these girls and women who migrated.
And I'd just come back, I'd been in New York just a couple of weeks ago.
Right, okay.
And I'd had the kids with me, and I kind of had forgotten, you know, seen it through their eyes, and I thought, they have come from Cowtown, and they're, you know, and even though they, you know, there's a sense of, you know what, in a sense, you see New York in films and movies and pictures, you know, in a sense, what you're coming to, much more than these migrants would have known at all, but still, the number of people, the sounds, the noise. It was very warm.
Yeah.
You know, all of that is huge. You know, is huge for us today,
yeah.
who have got so much more knowledge and understanding before we go. But I think that that is just a small bit of how extreme this would have been and how confusing and frightening.
No, absolutely. There's a letter we have in our database from a woman called Maggie Black. And she was from rural Ulster. I can't remember exactly where. I think it was County Tyrone. And she's in Chicago around 1890. And in one of the letters, she simply says to her sister back here, she says about the heat, and she says, sure wasn't a power boiled. Which I just think is a beautiful turn of phrase. Leslie, so other groups who are obviously other women from Italy or Germany or other European countries in the similar kind of urban context, how similar or different do you think the Irish experience was in that context?
I think it was quite different in that the Irish girls and women are more likely to be travelling alone than women in other ethnic groups. Travelling, you know, not as part of a family unit, not travelling as wives, in say with Italian migrants, where the girls and women were generally travelling in that family unit. So I think that then sets the Irish up for a different experience. They have, you know, we can see that they're going over to an aunt or they're going over to a sister. We have that, we see that that chain migration that you've written about quite a lot. But it does mean that they're having to find a job very quickly. They're in a way vulnerable, so they're vulnerable to perhaps unwanted attention, but they also are unchaperoned and have this kind of new sense of freedom, and there's no kind of twitching curtains watching what they're getting up to. And so that can then lead to them, you know, ending up in the courts or ending up in the prison system or ending up needing help from institutions. And that's where we then pick them up in the records.
Thanks. This is not just the book, but this is a suite of of different. You've got the podcast, which has proved really successful. And you've got the exhibition at the Ulster American Folk Park, which is still on for a period of time. So anyone out there, please come along and see that. Just interested again in the sort of, I think this is very much the future in a way of academic outputs. I mean, it's very much delivering dissemination, you know, getting academic research out there. So, I mean, the interrelationship between these elements, any thoughts on that?
I think the project has evolved and is very different to the project, the funding application that we put in for. And a number of things, we didn't have a podcast, for example, as one of our outputs, and we didn't have an exhibition in the way that it is now as one of our outputs either. But we, you know, we ended up doing the podcast during COVID, you know, things that we didn't know were going to happen when we'd put in for our initial funding, and I suppose that we sort of adapted and changed, and really different things happened that changed the way that, so when the podcast happened, I mean, and we kind of laughed about it, saying that we didn't think anybody would listen to it. I thought my mum might. Elaine didn't even think her mum would. So that was the level we were kind of at with it. And then, you know, we were again very surprised at the success.
Delighted.
Yeah. But what it did show us was that there was a genuine, real interest from the general public about the story. So that made us change. I mean, a book was always planned, but we had sort of thought it would be a probably an academic book. But we were then thinking, well, hang on, there is a real public interest in these stories. Let's rethink and see if we can do this a different way. So that's where that came out of. And from then, you know, again, the success and the interest in the podcast and some of the other activities that we were doing, we ended up, you know, talking to people from National Museums Northern Ireland about the project and about what we could do. And then, you know, so that things have changed along the way. And I think we have been able to adapt and move with those, and to see actually there's a way of doing this differently, or there's interest in a particular aspect of this, and sort of moving in different ways,
like using the stories to tell the using the individual stories to tell the I suppose the wider, or give the wider picture of what Irish female migration was like.
And I mean, there clearly has been a great response. I mean, people clearly are interested in the human stories that are being revealed in through academic research. So, I mean, I think you've really, that's to be thoroughly congratulated for that. I think it's wonderful. Final question really is about, it's a horrible question to be asked, but, you know, if you had your time over again, what would you do differently? You know, that, is there anything that you'd kind of want to change? Or
I suppose we have hundreds of stories, thousands of stories that could have made it into the book. So for me, it was always that kind of, like, you know, it's heartbreaking when you have to make that decision as a writer, I suppose, what's going in and what's not going in, and whatever story you include. And Leanne said, you know, we wanted to include stories that were representative of, say, a wider theme. So sometimes it was a story that, you know, maybe it was from the same locality and we didn't want to have too many stories coming from the same place, or was telling a similar story to another. So I suppose I would just love if the book was, you know, five times the length and we could have included hundreds more. Bad Bridget's in there, be fantastic, but maybe we'll do something else with the other stories.
I know, we obviously, there's, you know, Bad Bridget Returns, or, you know, there's lots of, you know. And I think there's probably things that we might have thought, you know, in terms of gathering material. Mm-hmm. I think when we started the project, we had this great idea that we would be able to go into, we'd go three cities, we'll go into the archives, we'll gather all the material, and we'll be able to produce these spreadsheets which show us exactly how many Irish women were being arrested or going to prison in all of our cities, and we'll have all these comparative figures. And, you know, this will be brilliant. And of course, very quickly we realised that we're just not going to be able to do this. We weren't, you know, we knew there were going to be a lot of them. We were not prepared for the sheer numbers. So, for example, in somewhere like New York, we were having to sort of sample maybe 2 months in a year in every 5 years, because physically we couldn't even, and that was where it was, all the records were on microfilm, but you had to print off the microfilm. You couldn't even take pictures of the microfilm. So I was having to physically print sheets. I had to buy a new suitcase because I had so much, you know, paper to bring back. And we realized at that point, you know, we were gathering lots and lots of material, but actually, as Elaine was saying, about it was about the key stories. So, you know, probably we should have had factored in a whole lot of other trips to go back then again to,
but then
to
try COVID hit,
and we couldn't get back to get all those stories. And but in saying that, so many of the archivists and librarians have been absolutely brilliant and been able to scan records, find things for us, and send us material when we realized, actually, you know, we want more in this person, and that those weren't records we looked at the last time or thought would be relevant. So there are little things like that I suppose, if that, knowing now what was going to work, but you have to do the, you have to do it first to know, you know, how it would work.
But again, just by way of congratulation, I mean, it's a book that has a real connection with where we are today. I mean, this is, you know, people always going on about historians and what's happening in the contemporary world, but with contemporary issues that we have and migration bills going through Parliament and all that, that actually this is a terrific book for making people empathise, to understand the lives of migrants, and actually then to reflect on the challenges that are there in the contemporary world. So, you know, you've humanised that and made the connection to a wider audience and drawn them into historical social history, and that's terrific. And I hope very pertinent as well. So, listen, thanks so much for sharing your time and your thoughts with us. It's been really interesting.
Thanks so much.
Good luck in the future.
Thank you.
Museum with Victoria Miller, curator at National Museums NI, In many ways, I think, Victoria, we probably should be doing this in our home in the Ulster American Folk Park, but we'll try and imagine we're there, where it's the home of the Bad Bridget exhibition. And for me, as someone who's been working there for, you know, just over a year and a half, this is a very much a new departure for the Ulster American Folk Park, which, in very commas, there's a lot of traditionality on it. But tell me about the genesis of the project, of, you know, it coming in there.
Yeah, it was. It came about just sort of very timely in terms of what Elaine and Leanne were doing with Bad Bridget, the research project, and then what we were trying to hopefully achieve at the Ulster American Folk Park. It had been a number of years in the making, spearheaded by Liam Corey, who's the curator of emigration at the Ulster American Folk Park. We embarked on this project called Expanding the Narrative, so it was looking at how we could expand the narrative further at the folk park that's not always focusing on the success stories of mainly male Ulster migrants, and opening that up to like a wider spectrum. And one of the, or two of the key areas we were looking at was women's experiences of migration, but also migration to urban centres that doesn't get that much of a spotlight on it at the folk park at present. So it did come about rather to sort of happenstance that Elaine and Leanne were doing a taster for the project at the Folk Museum at Cultraw, and then sort of staff then were made aware of the project and sort of saw the parallels between what Elaine and Leanne were doing and what we were hoping to achieve at the museum. So we then started having discussions to see, is there any sort of scope for this to become something at the folk park, whether it could be an exhibition or what have you. And then it sort of just sort of snowballed from there, really. And it really was a great opportunity for us, in terms of, we obviously have the temporary gallery at the folk park and it changes every so many years. So the exhibition that was on there, it was sort of due to be renewed. And then we thought this could be sort of the next one in line for the gallery.
One of the things I admire about it is I think you took it to a level of, I'm very interested in, you know, we often think about the visual and, you know, there's the sights, the sounds, the smells, the touches even. And I think that's a level you took it to. Many years ago, I was involved in a project in a certain area, and we went for a work. Now, what word describes your area? It was something I learned, you know, kind of ethnographers use this. And I remember the person said, well, there's a smell, because this area I was doing some work and there was a dump and there was also a meat factory. So was that a new departure for yourselves, this kind of what we call sort of sensory ethnography, telling the stories through the senses?
I think so, especially to that extent that we did push it. So at the museums here, sometimes maybe even here at the Ulster Museum, you would have had smells incorporated as part of a display. But in terms of the sights, sounds and smells all kind of working as one, it was a new departure for us, definitely. It was sort of when we first started, we were thinking, how will our collections kind of complement the research, because we didn't have any objects that belonged to any of the actual girls or women themselves. So we had to kind of think about how we were going to reflect their stories through the objects first and foremost, and then also thinking about how we were going to provide a hook for contemporary visitors. So we went down the line of the, you know, contemporary illustration to kind of give it a bit of a modern feel. We also brought in the other sensory elements like the sounds and the smells, just to give other layers that allow people to interact with the stories beyond sort of, you know, the traditional presentation that you would could normally see in a museum. And even the first person plural, the use of that through the text panels and the labels. I think all of us were quite wary of that at the start, thinking, how's that going to work and how's it going to complement the objects? But then when we all saw a sample of it, we thought, no, it could actually really work and make it more personalised, and sort of getting people to connect with the objects and thinking, these are the types of things that these girls and women would have handled and took with them or had in their homes and things like that.
And is that, as a curator, is that a difficult thing to combine, you know, the kind of the comic book strip with the traditional, you know, medical instruments, religious objects, all that material culture?
I think so initially, because it was a you know, it was a bit of an unknown how they were going to complement one another. But I think seeing them all in situ, it really does provide sort of a nice juxtaposition between the old, if you want to call the objects the old, and the new with the contemporary illustrations. I think they do really complement one another, and even just to see sort of an older painting right beside a contemporary illustration, it kind of gives that sort of nice sort of comparison. And if you do look closely at the illustrations, what the illustrator's done is try to incorporate some of the objects on display into the illustrations. So we've got things like the rosary beads, for example, or some of the school objects on display are incorporated in the illustrations, which is a nice sort of complement between the two, that they're kind of speaking to one another.
And of course, as part of the suite, or the different platforms you have a wonderful voiceovers and interviews with people as well, and Jan Carson. I mean, you know, tell me about that other whole layer of it as well.
Yeah, so as Elaine and Liam were saying, you know, some of the stories, or quite a lot of the stories that they were uncovering, were quite piecemeal, so you maybe didn't get the full story attached to a particular girl or woman. So with the voiceovers and sort of the narrative pieces that were compiled by Jan Carson, she used elements of the research but then had to add to them to create a fuller story. So we did want to make clear when people were listening to these that they weren't sort of oral history recordings of the actual women themselves. They were sort of an imagined version of what happened to a particular woman or girls. So we kind of went down that road to tell the story. We also worked closely together on selecting the appropriate stories. So quite as what Elena and Liam were saying about the book, having to sort of be selective in the stories that they were portraying in the book, we had to be even more selective with the stories we were able to tell in the exhibition. So we only have, you know, six key stories that were represented through the sounds and the interviews and the oral histories. So we had to select those based on maybe the age of the person or where they were from, and then also thinking about the person who was going to act in that voice. So, you know, getting sort of a younger person to portray, say, for example, a 16-year-old versus an older person to portray someone who was maybe in their 70s or 80s. So that was interesting as well, to kind of play around with that and see how they were working. And people have, you know, really well responded well to those.
I'm just thinking about that. You know, this is part of the wider expanding the narrative, as National Museums call it. So I understand there's four kind of themes: urbanism, which we've looked at, and the role of women, and then there is Indigenous peoples and slavery and how they're represented or not represented. Do you see going forward, you know, that this is a model, you know, for the other elements of it as where museums go? I'm just thinking, you know, the holistic way of this, with really good research, but actually really accessible. I mean, I think we've previously heard that, you know, this is the way forward. This is, you know, universities talk about impact, but this is impact. But do you putting you in the spot, but do you see this is a kind of a model of a way going forward for those other elements, like possibly slavery and Indigenous peoples?
Yeah, potentially. I think there is this sort of a confidence now that we have at National Museums NI to maybe do similar projects, not just maybe at the Ulster Mountain Folk Park, but our other sites. You know, obviously we've worked with academic partners in the past, but maybe not as complete as this, where we're really using the research of the academic partners to then inform the exhibitions or the interpretation that we have on site. So it has been really successful, and it is something then we could consider certainly for other elements of the narratives we want to tell at the Folk Park and other sites here at National Museums NI.
I mean, relating to that, you know, I don't know, I can't think exactly how long we were all at the opening of it. I don't even know, it seems like yesterday, but it's a good few months or a year ago now, is it? I mean, yeah. What's your general feedback that you've been getting from the public? Because I mean, for me, it is quite a radical departure in the Ulster American Folk Park. It's like light and dark. Excuse the pun, but you know, what's the feedback you're getting from the public generally?
really positive on the whole. Like, we haven't really had any sort of negative feedback. I think initially when we were talking about the subject matter of the exhibition, but also incorporating some of these more contemporary elements, we thought, are people going to get it? Are they going to be turned off by it? But no, everyone's been really positive. We've got an evaluation form in the exhibition so people can fill that out, and we also have a response wall, and even actually the response wall has been giving us even more sort of qualitative feedback than we were expecting. People are making comparisons of sort of modern day migration and women's experiences today, making comparisons with the like Roe v. Wade ruling and things, and thinking back on women's fortunes, you know, 100 or 150 years ago. So it's really encouraging to see, you know, that some of the aims we had for the exhibition to kind of bring it up to, you know, people making it of use and of benefit to them today, you know, has really kind of come to pass. And I think the figures that we've got back from the evaluation have been really encouraging in terms of, I think it's over 85% of people said they've went away feeling that they've learned something new. They're really connecting, you know, in terms of the emotive elements of the exhibition, and really connecting with the stories, which is something we really wanted to sort of convey in the exhibition. So it's all been really positive. And in terms of the sights, sounds and the smells, they're all ranking really highly in terms of people and really seeing the value in them, as well as the objects. So they all seem to be working well together and giving people a really good experience.
I mean, the reason for studying history is the lessons we learn and what we're doing today. And I mean, I have to say, I found it very emotional, and that whole concept of empathy, you know, particularly, you know, I've learned so much this last year and a half, younger women, you know, on their own. And you think about, you know, people still being sold into slavery and prostitution and arriving at a place on their own. I think it's an incredibly powerful to do that. So there's no disconnect between, no border or boundary between what's happening today and what's happened in the past. Yeah, the length of the voyages might differ, the various things, but actually the similarities are, I mean, you just have to look at the paper today, and you look at a ship they're putting people on. I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty horrendous. I would say we have have two very critical older daughters, 27 and 25. They're very critical of their old fogey dad, and we bought the book and have been to the exhibition, and they're my biggest critics, and absolutely, yeah, it's an interesting to say, you know, you love the book, you know, in a way. We've talked about that earlier. It's not an easy read. I mean, I can still in my mind, you know, the last, you know, person going to their death. I mean, it's very powerful. And I applaud all of you for doing it, and I think, you know, going forward, I'm thinking about slavery, I'm thinking Indigenous peoples and the lessons, what you learn from that. So thank you, Victoria.
Thank you. Thanks.